Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. It's a delight to be able to catch up with a friend and colleague of many years, Kenneth Timmerman. He is a man of many parts, including a very accomplished veteran investigative reporter, an author, a novelist, including most recently a book that will be out on the 10th of July, ISIS Begins, which is a novel about Christian persecution in Iraq. It is a delight to have him with us. He has, among other things, promoted democracy in Iran as the president and CEO of the Foundation for Democracy in Iran, and has, to his credit, any number of fiction and nonfiction books, as well as countless periodical articles and investigative reports. It's always great to catch up with him. Ken, thanks so much for taking a few minutes to do so.
Frank, it's a pleasure to be with you. Thanks for having me on.
Well, you have a new book. I know that it can be pre-ordered at Amazon, and it's highly recommended because your books tend to run out then, and then they can't get their hands on them quite quickly. But tell us a little bit about ISIS Begins and the plot line that is pretty compelling.
Thanks. I decided to ultimately write this as a novel. I've been working for many years with Christians in Iraq, going on mission trips to northern Iraq, and working with Christian groups in the United States as well. And I realized it was hard to get traction either with church groups or with publishers or the rest, just writing articles or writing nonfiction. And a mutual friend of ours, Keith Roderick, who's deceased since then, said, Ken, you've got to write this as a novel. Write a book about the Christians of Iraq, a book with a Christian narrator, a Christian protagonist, to make it real for people, so people could feel what it's like to be a Christian in a Muslim country in Iraq when you are being not just harassed, but you're being really hounded to death by jihadi Muslim groups. And that's what ISIS Begins does. It's set in northern Iraq just before the ISIS invasion to Mosul and the Nineveh Plains, which we've read about for the past 3 years, when they, you know, massacred Christians, crucified Christians, beheaded people. But we didn't hear the personal story. So this is the personal story. And by the way, all of us who had been there on the ground saw this coming. There's no JV team. It wasn't true. Everybody saw ISIS coming. That's why I call the book ISIS Begins, because it was there in northern Iraq as Obama was pulling U.S. troops out of Iraq. That's where ISIS began.
Yeah. And Ken, we've done some work on this ourselves in connection particularly with this new coalition, the Save the Persecuted Christians Coalition, to try to help people understand that this is a global problem. You've done a great job of characterizing one of its most gripping manifestations, but it's unbelievable that some 215 million Christians around the world are being subjected to similar kinds of mistreatment and even genocide. And just quickly, before we turn to another related topic, what should people be thinking and doing to try to help stop this kind of persecution?
Well, the first thing, Frank, I think we have to recognize ourselves as Christians, whether we are Protestant or Anglican or Catholic or whatever we are, that we are all the same. We are brothers and sisters in Christ, and too often we allow our own sectarian differences to get in the way. We say, well, those Christians getting persecuted there, they're not of my faith, they're of a different faith. No, that's not right. They're Christians. They're our brothers and sisters in Christ, and Jesus said, you will be persecuted in my name, and that's exactly what happens and what's happening today. I think that really is the single most important thing. All of us in the United States, in particular, should recognize that these are our brothers and sisters in Christ, no matter what their particular sectarian belief.
Yeah, and I'm fond of saying that as long as the persecutors don't differentiate between the Christians, various denominations. We ought to be able to look beyond it ourselves and come together. And the point of this coalition, as you know, Ken, is to see if we can't help foster a public outcry and indeed a movement behind holding the persecutors accountable and creating real costs to them for doing what they're doing. This is work that's important, and you're making a very important contribution to it with your new novel, ISIS Begins. Order it at Amazon, folks. Now, quickly, let me turn to another matter, Ken. As I mentioned, you've spent much of your professional life trying to help bring democracy to Iran and otherwise end the horrific regime that began with the Ayatollah Khomeini in 1979. And there seems to be at the moment about as good an opportunity has ever been to try to bring that about. There was a very large gathering of some 100,000 people or so in Paris over the weekend that Rudy Giuliani and Newt Gingrich addressed, among others. It was organized by a group called the National Council for Resistance in Iran, also associated with the Mujahideen El-Khalq, M-E-K. Would you tell us a little bit about the sponsors of this group and this demonstration, this meeting, this event, and whether they're a part of the solution to what's happening in Iran at the moment?
Yeah, the MEK has been holding these meetings every year for 40 years almost. They pay people to come. It's a rent-a-crowd or rent-a-mob, if you wish. It's not 100,000. It's probably a couple of thousand. But they pay people to come to listen to their leader, who they have already selected as the president-elect of Iran. I have a real problem with the MEK. Most Iranians have a real problem with them. The Shah called them Islamist Marxists, which is exactly what they are. They're Islamists. And they are Marxists. They are the flip side of the current Islamist regime. I don't think that they would, should they come to power, change an awful lot in Iran that we really care about. They would continue to have an Islamic state. I call Iran the Islamic State of Iran, not the Islamic Republic of Iran. And I think, frankly, the MEK would continue the Islamic State of Iran. And that's my real problem. Iranians have a problem with them because they sided with Saddam Hussein during the 1980 to 88 Iran-Iraq war. Rajavi, their leader, went to Baghdad, was photographed kissing Saddam Hussein. Those pictures are all over the internet. They're at our website, iran.org, and elsewhere. And Iranians never forget that. He kissed the dictator who was slaughtering their countrymen. And it's really hard to get over that.
Yeah, it is indeed. So, Ken, talk to me about the prospects for, well, a revolution, I guess is the only way to think of it, or counter-revolution in Iran today. There are enormously turbulent forces at work, including widespread drought at the moment. Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister of Israel, has played nicely to this problem by offering help to the people of Iran in getting water, something Israel specializes in. What do you think are the chances that we might actually find this regime coming apart at the seams? And what should the United States be doing now to help bring that about?
Well, I think things as far as a protest movement against the regime are further advanced than they have ever been. We've had rolling protests for 6 months, 7 months actually, since this past December. The regime has not been able to put them down.
Yeah. Ken Timmerman, congratulations again on the publication of ISIS Begins. Order it now, folks, at Amazon. Ken, God bless you. We'll talk with you again soon. Next up, Michael Cutler joins us right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are joined by Michael Cutler, the man we turn to with regularity to discuss matters of immigration policy and practice, something he knows a lot about by virtue of having spent his adult life, basically, in the practice of both immigration policy and programs. He is a veteran of the Immigration and Naturalization Services, in which he rose to the ranks of the senior special agents. Now retired, he is a very active contributor to the public policy debate, notably with posts at Front Page magazine. He's also the star of his own radio program, The Michael Cutler Hour, heard Friday evenings on Blog Talk Radio. Michael Cutler, welcome back. It's so good to have you.
Frank, thanks so much for having me and covering the topic.
Thank you. Well, it's an important topic, needless to say, and the more so because at the moment there seems to be a bit of a lemmings rush on the part of a lot of Democrats to abolish something called ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, I believe is the formal title. But tell us what ICE does, Michael Cutler, and why it's important not to abolish it.
Well, you know, I have to start out by saying that some of the loons on the left that have been calling for the abolition of ICE, talking about how it was formed about 16 or 17 years ago, it was, but it's not as though immigration law enforcement didn't exist before then. It was the INS, and that's where I spent 30 years of my career. And it's charged basically with backing up the Border Patrol and backing up the inspectors at ports of entry. When aliens gain entry into the United States, one of the key issues for ICE is the enforcement of the immigration laws from within the interior of the United States. And to underscore its significance, all five branches of the U.S. military have a common mission, that mission to keep America's enemies as far from our shores as possible. Up close and in person, however, when the bad guys get beyond those borders of ours or approach our borders, elements of the Department of Homeland Security, again, the word security, are supposed to take over. The Border Patrol is supposed to interdict those who would attempt to enter the United States without inspection. The inspectors at the ports of entry, the job I did for the first 4 years of my career, are supposed to inspect the passengers arriving on airplanes or footbridges, however they come, land border, sea border, airport, to make certain that the aliens in question are not excludable. Excludable, by the way, based on being aliens with dangerous diseases, mental illness, criminals, spies, terrorists, human rights violators, fugitives from justice, or aliens who might take the jobs that Americans desperately need. There's nothing about race or religion in that. And so if you eliminate immigration law enforcement, in essence, you're taking down the shields that are supposed to protect America from people who wish us harm. Indeed, the 9/11 Commission made it clear that multiple failures of the immigration system were at the root ability of the terrorists, not only on 9/11, but they studied other terrorists as well. All of them committed violations of immigration law and procedures and left us vulnerable. So why in the world, with all this going on for the backdrop, would any rational person want to leave America vulnerable to transnational gangs and international terrorist organizations?
Well, rational is the operative word that may not apply. But let me just ask you, Michael, when we talk, as we do now from time to time, about immigration, you always impress upon us how important that interior enforcement is, that as you say, that every state is now a border state and should be considered as such for the purposes of protecting our people. There aren't that many ICE officers, as I understand it. The idea that we could somehow dispense with their services or even go through the exercise of telling them to stand down while we reimagine what they do seems to me to be simply a formula. Well, the president has said as much. You're not going to want to leave your house if that were to happen.
No, that's right. And look, there's nothing wrong with arresting illegal aliens. If you enter the United States illegally, you're trespassing. And you know, it's remarkable. Chuck Schumer actually proposed legislation a couple of years ago that would call for a 5-year maximum federal penalty for anybody who would trespass on critical infrastructure or national landmarks. I think Chuck is onto something. But the same Chuck Schumer and his friends over in the Democrat Party seem to think that when you trespass on America, you're now entitled to U.S. citizenship. Never mind not deport these folks. Let's give them citizenship, the keys to the kingdom. You know, I'm trying to understand a rational thought process behind all of this. And I got to tell you, I come up empty.
Yeah. Well, as I say, I'm not sure that's what's at work.
Yeah. I mean, I'm registered as a Democrat, but these people aren't Democrats. I think they've really fallen off the edge of the earth. I think maybe the Flat Earth Society is onto something.
Yeah. Well, the one that has brought this to the forefront, of course, is the lady who just defeated a member of the House Democratic leadership, Jill Crowley. And she has taken the position that as a Democratic socialist, she is entitled to, you know, think big.
Yeah, but you know what? Senator Gillibrand from New York is also saying the same things as are others. This now seems to be the new chorus line. And, you know, what they're calling for borders on sedition, You know, and by the way, aliens who pay smugglers to bring them to the United States are being portrayed in the media as victims of human trafficking. It's patently absurd. It's kind of like a guy that goes to a prostitute, then accusing the prostitute of raping him. You know, they are co-conspirators in the crime of unlawful entry into the United States. And so when you pay a smuggler to bring you here, don't you think that there should be penalties for that?
Yeah, no, I sure do. There is a complaint that somehow the ICE officers have been mutated in terms of their responsibilities into a deportation force by President Trump and his administration. How would you respond to that charge?
I wish they were, but they do a lot more than that also. And we have precious few ICE agents. And I would argue by design, because truthfully, both sides of the political aisle don't really want effective immigration law enforcement. Immigration, by the way, is not failing. If you look at it as a delivery system, it's highly effective. It's more efficient, in fact, than FedEx or UPS combined. Look, right now, the broken, so-called broken immigration system delivers an unlimited supply of foreign cheap workers, foreign tourists, foreign students, and for the immigration attorneys in the Congress, and there are many, an unlimited supply of clientele for immigration lawyers. And if you look at both the Goodlatte bill and you look at the Ryan bill, both thankfully failed to pass, neither bill called for the hiring of a single additional ICE agent. The Goodlatte bill would have hired 10,000 more people for Customs and Border Protection. That would include Border Patrol agents, inspectors at ports of entry and support staff, but not one single additional ICE agent. Right now, we've got about 6,000 ICE agents for the whole country. As the name implies, they enforce more than immigration law, and I would argue that maybe that was a mistake. And in fact, I testified before Congress that it was a mistaken idea to merge immigration enforcement with other agencies, an issue that, by the way, then chairman of the Immigration Subcommittee, John Hostetler, backed me up on. We've diluted the immigration mission. So right now, maybe you've got 3,000 ICE agents for the entire United States of America. Put that in perspective, Frank. We've got 15,000 FBI agents, 45,000 employees at TSA, 20,000 Border Patrol agents. New York City has over 37,000 police officers. And for the entire United States of America, we have approximately 3,000 ICE agents. The goal appears to be to create the illusion of protecting our borders and enforcing our laws, but not really doing it, which is why I believe that President Trump is getting so much pushback from both the Democrats and the Republicans. They are globalists, and he is not. And if you believe in sovereign borders, then you need to understand the significance of enforcing immigration laws from within the interior. And by the way, it's not just about arresting people. It's working on the Joint Terrorism Task Force or the Drug Task Force, where I spent 10 years. It's about conducting fraud investigations. Immigration fraud identified by the 9/11 Commission as a key entry and embedding tactic of the terrorists. But the lack of integrity to the immigration system that ICE agents are supposed to combat, they're having a hell of a time doing it because they lack the resources.
They lack the resources, and it may be the upside of the conversation that we are having about the future of ICE should be, Michael Cutler, to increase the number of agents and perhaps narrow somewhat their responsibilities so as to focus particularly on this critically important mission of immigration enforcement interior to the United States. Let me ask you quickly, you mentioned the Ryan bill going down to a crushing defeat. The Goodlatte measure was also defeated, but by a narrower margin. Where do you think we are now, Michael, on these various legislative fixes to various pieces of the immigration challenge that we're facing? And do you agree with me that the president is absolutely right when he says, let's let the voters decide on this fall, and then make decisions about what we're going to do to fix or change or otherwise adjust our policies and practices?
Look, any politician who calls for dismantling ICE and stopping the enforcement of our immigration laws is being tone deaf to the American people and also ignoring the findings and recommendations of the 9/11 Commission. You know, they just had yet another hearing over in the House Homeland Security Committee, Peter King chairing the hearing on sleeper agents operating in the United States. He's held many hearings on the topic. I raised the issue of sleeper agents when I testified before the House Immigration Subcommittee in 2004, if I remember correctly, way back then. And we've done absolutely nothing to address this critical issue that undermines national security and leaves us vulnerable to terrorist attacks. I just saw breaking news that the FBI uncovered yet another terror plot in Cleveland for the 4th of July of some individual that was supporting foreign terrorist operations in the United States. Our borders are our first and last line of defense. The entire immigration system really needs to be thought of as a component of our military system designed to keep us free and safe of enemy combatants. There's no sensible, rational reason why you would take your shields down at a time when we're so concerned about national security that we continually read reports about 90-year-old women in wheelchairs being strip searched because they're trying to get on board an airplane. Look, if we're that concerned about safety, how in the world do you ignore the 9/11 Commission findings that addressed immigration with unequivocal terms?
Much, much more comprehensively. Absolutely right. Michael Cutler, we have to leave it at that. This topic is not going away. I know you won't either. We're looking forward to visiting with you further. Michael, thank you so much, my friend. We'll talk with you again soon. Next up, Gordon Chang joins us. We'll take stock of the latest on North Korea and China and more right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We are joined by Gordon Chang, a man we have the privilege of visiting with about this time each week. He is our duty expert on matters involving Asia and that of much of the rest of the free world, including The Daily Beast, where he is a columnist, as well as Fox News. And he is the author of two very important books, The Coming Collapse of China and Nuclear Showdown North Korea Takes on the World. Gordon, welcome back. Always good to have you.
Thank you so much, Frank.
Well, some very important reports coming out of Asia these days, and I wanted to get your thoughts on them. The first involves evidence that apparently U.S. intelligence has been picking up that far from denuclearizing, the North Koreans seem to be, I'm shocked to hear, continuing their nuclear program and going to considerable lengths at the moment to try to conceal what evidence there is of that from us. I doubt that you're shocked about this, but what do you make of it, Gordon? And where should we be going with these talks with the North Koreans?
There are two reports of great significance. One of them is that the North Koreans have been improving the cooling system of their 5-megawatt plutonium-producing reactor at Yongbin. The other is what we've just learned in the last few hours, that they're continuing construction at a facility that builds parts for their solid fuel missiles. Neither of these reports are consistent with what President Trump has said, that Kim Jong-un has made a decision to give up his weapons. And there's a couple possibilities, Frank. Either that Kim is deceiving President Trump, which is what most people believe, or there's another possibility, which is even more disturbing, and that is Kim does not control the military. We know that of the constituent elements of the regime, Kim has the least command of the military. There was the reshuffle of the top three posts, the defense minister and the top two posts in the Korean People's Army, as well as the execution of a high-ranking general. This indicates fluidity at the top of the Korean People's Army and is some further evidence that Kim certainly doesn't control it as much as he controls the other elements of his regime, the Korean Workers' Party and the security services. So the basis of President Trump's policy that North Korea will disarm quickly, I think, has been undercut. Certainly, President Trump needs to explain to the American people why he's continuing policies which, in the short term, undermine American security.
Gordon, do you think that if the dictator of North Korea is not firmly in charge of the North Korean military, that they are rather more aligned and responsive to communist China and its direction?
That's a great question, Frank, and I wish I knew the answer. We know that the Chinese have been giving Kim sort of an incentive to defy the demands of the international community and the United States to disarm. President Trump has talked about that in public twice recently, including at the press conference after his June 12th summit. And so we know that the Chinese are up to troublemaking. The specific form of that troublemaking and how much they've communicated their desires to the North Korean regime, you know, we just don't know. But we do know that President Trump has, although he's called China to account in public, has yet to impose any costs on Beijing. And he needs to do so because otherwise he is basically saying to the world, yes, I know the Chinese have been violating sanctions, but I'm not doing anything about it. And that to me is untenable.
Gordon, I want to come back to China in a minute, but to the extent that North Korea is in fact now acting in a manner inconsistent with the commitments that President Trump thought he secured from Kim Jong-un at their Singapore summit, what would you recommend he do at the moment? We're going to be talking shortly with Greg Scarlatou about human rights in North Korea, which have seemingly not gotten much attention. But even with respect to the nuclear program itself, let alone the larger threat that North Korea's conventional forces and other weapons of mass destruction programs represent to our allies and to us, what should the president be doing at this point?
Now, there's reporting that Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is going to Pyongyang, and I think that this is the put-up-or-shut-up moment. Either Kim makes a clear commitment to give up his weapons and does so in writing, or I think we have to go back to the maximum pressure campaign. In other words, we need to start imposing even stricter sanctions on North Korea. We need to go after North Korea's big power sponsors, the Russians and the Chinese, preferably by disconnecting some Chinese banks from the global banking system for money laundering for North Korea. We need to resume our exercises with South Korea. All of these things need to be back on the agenda. This is how we got Kim to the bargaining table in the first place. And President Trump's diplomacy through the end of May was brilliant. But his diplomacy at the summit really was disappointing, as almost everyone has said, except, of course, his supporters and administration officials. So what we need to see is President Trump going back to his winning ways, which is what he was doing up through the end of May.
So you would not, in short, recommend at this point holding another summit with Kim Jong-un, I take it?
This, to me, is incomprehensible. The reports that we saw in Axios today that administration officials are so optimistic about the trend of events that they want to arrange a second summit with Kim Jong-un in New York at the time of the UN General Assembly meeting. This will further benefit Kim, and clearly it's not the thing to do unless Secretary of State Pompeo is able to get those commitments that I talked about. If he gets those commitments and we are on a path to denuclearization, then yes, we can have all the summits we want. But until Kim makes that commitment, and right now that's very much in doubt, there should be no talk on the part of the administration that they'll do anything that would be of benefit to the North Korean regime. This is just wrong, Frank.
Yeah. I would add to your list that there actually needs to be tangible signs that are verified that he's actually moving to dismantle his nuclear program, not simply promise to do so, even if it's in writing this time. It seems to me we need, before there's further legitimation of this regime, tangible proof that it's moving materially in the right direction.
Well, you know, at Secretary Pompeo's meeting, he needs to get the commitment, and sorry for being in saying this in a shorthand way, is first of all a commitment to give up all ballistic missiles and nuclear weapons, to dismantle all the infrastructure in North Korea for that, and of course to agree to the world's strictest inspections regime. And in addition, other promises that President Trump has made to the Japanese about getting an accounting for the abductees is something that's important. And there's a third item, which I think another item which we need to add to the list, and that is we need an accounting of those Americans who probably were kept by the North Koreans after the armistice, in violation of the armistice. There's substantial reporting that North Koreans kept at least were about 800 Americans. And we need to get an accounting for ourselves as we get an accounting of the Japanese abductees.
Right. The president, of course, has applauded the return of remains of Americans. But an accounting, as you say, for those who were not dead when the Korean War ended is long overdue indeed. Gordon, let me turn quickly to another report that I wanted to get your take on. Our friend and colleague Bill Gertz has a piece in the Washington Free Beacon today that describes at some length the interactions between Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis and General Zhu Qilang, the commander of the Chinese People's Liberation Army. There is an interesting subtext to this, in addition to sort of the overall theme that Mattis was rather forceful with Xi, that they are now strategic competitors of the United States, and that there is going to be a competition, in fact, between us as a result, that there is a lot of turmoil going on inside the People's Liberation Army at the hands of Xi Jinping and his right-hand man, Zhu Guilang. Would you describe your take on that proposition, that these guys are purging large numbers of generals and disciplining thousands of people in the ranks, presumably because they're not sufficiently loyal to Xi and his regime?
Yeah, there have been purges of senior generals and others, and I'm sure that it will continue. I believe that there is substantial turmoil inside the People's Liberation Army, and it is inappropriate, in my view, for Secretary Mattis to have talked to General Xu. What General Xu was trying to do was, and this is traditional Chinese tactics against the United States, is to say, oh, look, you know, we've got all these problems, you know, it's because there are other elements that are very dangerous, and we're trying our best to deal with this, so please give us some time. I think that it was fine for Mattis to talk to Xi Jinping, but, you know, at this point, this is not our problem, Frank. We should not be taking sides in any sort of disputes inside the Chinese military or the party or the government. You know, for us, you know, China has been engaging in unacceptable conduct, including injuring American pilots. And the message to Xi Jinping should be a very simple one. This has got to end, or there will be extremely severe consequences. You know, we have, at this point, been played by the Chinese far too long, and military-to-military contacts have not benefited the United States. And certainly, I think that continuing talking with any Chinese military officer is just not the thing that we need to do. The Trump administration was right to disinvite China from RIMPAC, the naval exercises that have now just started. We need to continue this process of no contact with the Chinese military until we see a substantial improvement in behavior.
Gordon, one of the other themes that Bill talks about is the possibility that a trigger-happy military commander might precipitate a shooting war between the United States and the Chinese. I think this is probably part and parcel of the argument that, no, we really do need to be in close contact with these guys. Your thoughts on that possibility?
Many American senior military officers have talked about rogue elements in the PLA, especially in the South China Sea, and pilots who have been challenging U.S. Air Force and Navy reconnaissance flights. Again, this is something where we say to the Chinese, you're responsible. These are your pilots.
Gordon, this is why we prize our time with you, is you've got a very clear view of what the Chinese are thinking, as well as what they're up to. Keep up the good work. Next up, Greg Scarlatiu of the Committee for Human Rights in North Korea. Straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, joined by Greg Scarlatiu. He is the executive director of the Committee for Human Rights in North Korea, a distinguished professor and scholar on matters involving Korea and obviously especially what's going on inside the so-called Hermit Kingdom of North Korea. He is the author of numerous commentaries and articles. He also was the author and broadcaster of the weekly Korean language Scarlatiu column aimed at North Korea by Radio Free Asia. He is a go-to guy for us on matters involving the North, and that's a particularly timely topic, as we were discussing a moment ago, Greg, with Gordon Chang, in light of developments including evidence that the North Korean regime is not, after all, engaged in good faith steps towards denuclearization. Welcome back, sir. It's so good to have you. Thank you for taking a few minutes with us.
Thank you, sir. The pleasure and honor are always mine. Thank you.
Thank you. So just as you have specialized particularly on the condition of human rights in North Korea, characterize them for us briefly, if you would, Greg, and why it's important for the United States in these talks with Kim Jong-un not to lose sight of the reality on the ground in that regard?
The Kim regime commits crimes against humanity, against its own people. It is one of the worst human rights violators in world history. There are 120,000 men, women, and children being held, imprisoned in North Korean political prison camps. The death rates are astoundingly high at these camps due to induced malnutrition, forced labor, secret executions, public executions. This is a regime that has engaged very recently in summit diplomacy with South Korea and the United States. This is a regime that prior to the inter-Korean summit meeting in April hosted a Korean-South Korean K-pop concert in the capital city of Pyongyang, a concert attended by high-ranking government officials and their families. In the meantime, ordinary North Koreans are denied access to information from the outside world. Just very recently, a Seoul-based media organization, Daily NK, reported that the North Korean regime is cracking down on miniskirts and anything that might have to do with Western influences. So the bottom line is that the Trump administration has effectively applied two elements of national power: the military element of national power through reinforcing alliances, deploying assets to the region; the economic element of national power through enforcing the sanctions regime and more effectively implementing sanctions. The Trump administration has also been experimenting with a diplomatic element of national power, but I have no doubt that no one inside the Trump administration, including the president himself, has any illusions about the true nature of the Kim regime.
Do you share the concern that many of the president's critics have about legitimating Kim Jong-un, a man who, as you say, has not only brutalized his people, as have his father and forefather before him, his grandfather before him, but has even exhibited unbelievably harsh behavior towards even members of his own family, killing one with an anti-aircraft weapon and another with a nerve agent? Should we, in fact, in your judgment, be engaging with such a man, let alone doing so without having at the very forefront of such interactions the character of his treatment of his own people?
Well, President Trump has hosted North Korean escapees at the State of the Union address at a meeting he held a few days later. I know all of them very well. I know that they had an excellent conversation. He was very well aware of everybody's background. They established a very good connection. The president understands the nature of the Kim regime. On the legitimacy issue, what I would like to say is even I and my organization, the Committee for Human Rights in North Korea, HRNK, would want to see a legitimate Kim regime that abides by its international obligations, because this is the only road to legitimacy. We want this regime to abide its obligations pursuant to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights as a UN member state, other human rights instruments that this regime has ratified. We would want to see this regime gain legitimacy through abiding by UN Security Council resolutions instructing that the Kim regime give up its nuclear weapons and ballistic missiles. Again, the president is experimenting with the diplomatic element of national power. Summit diplomacy is a tool that has not been employed before. Previously, across multiple administrations, we did see human rights being sacrificed on the altar of dealing with the very serious political security and military issues. That didn't really work for three decades, so perhaps right now it's high time we included human rights and ensured that human rights should stay within that set of critical issues that must be addressed in order to resolve the North Korean conundrum.
Well, this is, I guess, the balancing act that the president is trying to navigate. And, you know, it must be said that to the extent that the North Koreans are persisting in behavior that is at odds with their commitment to him, I trust that this is not going to sit well with the president or be papered over any more than the concerns that you've indicated he has about human rights will be shunted aside. I am struck by the interest that has been expressed by two members of the Senate, Bob Menendez of New Jersey and Cory Gardner of Colorado, in having congressional oversight of the negotiations that the president is engaged in, and Mike Pompeo and others, of course, in his administration. Your thoughts about that as a factor in trying to ensure that we both manage this properly and prudentially, and also to ensure that we're not neglecting some of the elements that I personally believe are fundamental to there being any prospect of a happy or useful arrangement here. I'm fond of saying, as I think I did the last time you were on, Greg Scarlato, that the nations that treat their own people terribly are unlikely to treat ours better. And I just want to see what your thoughts are on the Menendez-Gardner legislation. Is that a sensible thing for Congress to be doing?
By far, as one who has been addressing North Korean human rights for quite a few years, I can confidently say that Congress has been the most active branch of the U.S. government in addressing North Korean human rights. We have had a North Korean Human Rights Act since 2004. This act was, of course, reauthorized in 2008, then in 2012, and it will be very encouraging to know that President Trump signs the reauthorization of the 2004 North Korean Human Rights Act, extending it from 2018 to 2022. I think that congressional involvement in addressing North Korean issues, the role Congress has played in particular on North Korean human rights, has been a very positive one. And thus, I am very hopeful that we will see some progress.
Lastly, let me ask you, we now have an ambassador in South Korea at long last, Admiral Harry Harris. And I just wondered what your sense of the man is and whether this is a welcome development.
Ambassador Harris is actually of Japanese descent. I think he's a very, very fine choice, Frank, and he's the right man at the right time. We are faced with a very serious set of political security and military concerns. I think that it is, of course, his expertise and experience will enable him to be a very effective ambassador. And I also think that his particular set of expertise and his experience will send a very important signal, both to all friends, partners, and allies in South Korea, and also to the regime and the DPRK.
Well, it sounds right to me. I think that that skill set includes, among other things, his service as an exemplary commander of Pacific Command before his retirement from the Navy. We'll watch him closely. And Greg, we appreciate the chance to visit with you from time to time, and we'll be very anxious to take stock with you as to how things are going on the ground in North Korea. Come back to us again soon. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.